From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
This is Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, KPFT, FM 90.1, and digital FM 90.1, HD Channel 1. This is Houston's community station. Thank you for the gift of your time. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. Stephen L. Williams joined the City of Houston as the director of the Houston Health Department in June of 2004. He serves on several boards of community, professional, and civil rights organizations, and is the past president of the Texas Association of Local Health Officials. His most recent endeavor includes pioneering the recovery efforts for the COVID-19 pandemic. Stephen L. Williams, thank you for your efforts on behalf of Houston, and thank you for joining us on Open Journal.
Good to be here, Stephanie and Dewey.
It's great to spend some time to visit with you. We appreciate you carving out some space. I know you're a very, very busy man. I was just curious, Stephen, what was it growing up that developed your interest in health, and how did you begin this career path?
Well, actually, I didn't start out in public health. I actually started out in behavioral health, working in what I call a juvenile prison in Mount Meigs, Alabama, which is right outside of Montgomery. When I was in undergraduate school. Then did some work as a social work associate in the VA. And after doing that, I really got into behavioral health, became a house parent for the most part for the people who were in a transitional home, folks that were either coming out of state mental institutions, being transitioned back into society, or sometimes going into a transitional home to prevent them from going into the state-operated mental institutions. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until after a fellowship in county government that I pivoted into public health specifically.
Mm-hmm. For those who don't know the role of public health, and Duane and I have learned a lot, you know, me recently and then with the pandemic, and I think everyone understands some of it with Dr. Fauci and what that means. What is the mission of public health, and more importantly, the Houston Health Department?
Well, I like to think of public health being our invisible guardian. These are the folks that are really not only promoting health, but also protecting our community overall from disease, whether it's disease transmitted from humans to humans, from animals to humans, or from environment to humans. And so therefore, we do things like restaurant inspection. We do water sampling. We do air quality monitoring and investigating complaints around that. Most people don't see that. What they see is our operating health clinics and multi-service centers. They oftentimes confuse us with health care. We're not health care, although it looks like health care when you see us operating in clinics, but we're not anyone in this case, and some health departments are. We're not anyone's primary care provider, not the Houston Health Department is. We do operate dental services for children and seniors. We operate our health clinics doing immunizations, family planning, doing treatment, prevention of communicable diseases, and also we operate our women, infants, and children's program. Most people know that as WIC. That kind of looks, you know, like health care, but actually it's not. It's more of a preventive nature. In our department, we also operate the Area Agency on Aging for Houston and Harris County, and also the Aging and Disability Resource Center. Mainly that is to provide supportive services and information and service linkage to individuals that are 60 or above, are individuals with disabilities.
It's really robust what you do as a health department, and I think the invisible guardian is a good description because that's a vast range of ages and capacities of Houstonians that you protect.
That's very true. And one of the things that we do that most people don't understand is that we operate a regional laboratory that covers 17 surrounding counties. We're actually a reference lab for a lot of the medical institutions within Houston and Harris County. And probably with COVID, of course, people realize that everybody's heard contact tracing. You know? It's really been around for ages, case investigation. But mainly what we're trying to do there is let people know that they may have been in contact with someone who has a disease, and in this case, a virus, and might in fact have the virus, so they need to take precautions or go get tested, or if it's a communicable disease or whatever. Mm-hmm. Operating under our health authority, Dr. David Peirce, we do have the authority to actually quarantine people when they're not a client also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, we all think we're mini public health helpers now. We have a little vocabulary, right? It's kind of dangerous.
Yeah. Initially, you know, when COVID surfaced, we in the health department says now everybody has this public health expertise because everybody wants to tell you what to do and how to do it.
We try. But you're right. The health department really has been at the forefront of combating this pandemic. When the initial rumors of COVID-19 began to surface, when did you realize that this is going to be a real problem?
You know, initially when we saw this developing across the border, you know, as with all situations, we keep a watchful eye. And our epidemiologists are really kind of tracking it and giving us information regarding that. I think that we really began to open our eyes even wider when we knew that there was a transmission here within our community. You remember the closing of the rodeo. And before that, everybody that had tested positive for COVID, actually, those cases were related to travel. And initially, specifically, with the crews on the Nile, with a group of people who came back. But once we realized that there was evidence of community spread, then we knew that we were in for probably the fight of our lives.
Indeed.
Where we are now, we're beyond a year since the rodeo was shut down, and we missed out on our St. Patrick's Day party last year. And we've been practicing a lot, and the Houston Health Department's really been at the forefront of this campaign of raising awareness, getting people in underserved communities in particular, information and access through this Better Together, emphasizing the basics of washing hands and social distancing and masking up and getting tested. And I've been tracking this positive testing, hoping to see it go below 5% since we were told last spring to look for that. That's one of the things I remember Dr. Fauci said, we'd be in a good place if we can beat this thing down to 5%, below 5%, well below 5%. We were getting close a week or so ago, getting really close to 6. It's the last time I looked, it was back up over 7. What can you share about maybe that aspect of it? And then we can go beyond the testing, which I presume you still want people to be tested. But now we're in the process of this massive rollout of the vaccine. And my perception is that's where we really want to be directing people. I know I'm excited to have now gone beyond a month from my second exposure to the Moderna vaccine down at the Bayou Event Center. And it was like clockwork. It was a piece of cake to get in and out of that process, my wife and I. And it was a real testament to the organizational skill of the health department. But could you speak to the slight rise and never really beating down the testing positive aspect, and then we can dovetail into beyond testing into vaccines? Sorry for such a long question.
Well, I understand it. COVID is very complex. You're right on the mark when you're saying we really wanted to get well below 5%. But for several months now, we've actually been above 5%. And now we're right at about 9.8% within the city. A lot of that is related to individuals' behavior. That's the short and the long of it. I think that we are really spoiled. We want what we want when we want it, and we're not willing to sacrifice a whole lot. And when I'm talking about sacrificing, I'm talking about what some people would consider as an inconvenience, the mask. Right now I'm wearing two masks, and I've been wearing two masks for the last month or so. Oddly enough, I was talking to my optometrist, and of course he had on two masks too. We were talking about how much safer it is for us to both be in a room and don masks. But we have a lot of folks that are not willing to do that, and to some extent are engaging in denial. The basics, which you mentioned earlier, in terms of masking, in terms of engaging in social distancing and hand washing, are really the behaviors that will help to keep us safe. The testing gives us an idea of where we are, and testing rates are down right now. The vaccine is preventive in nature. But if we all engaged in all of that, and certainly taking the vaccine when it's your time, we would be in a much better place. But I believe, because we want to do what we want when we want it and call it personal freedoms, that we're in the state that we're in. You know, we're a rich country. We enjoy a lot of freedoms. And for me, I think it's time for us ideologically to get back to basics. We really are our brother's keeper, and I think that we need to hold that as a value as a country, so that when something like this happens, we're willing to make behavioral sacrifices, not only to protect ourselves, but our family, our loved ones, our neighbors, and our community overall.
Well, I wanted to follow up, Stephen, with a question related to the announcement a week and a half ago or so from our governor, because we're in the state of Texas, as well as in sometimes a selfish state of mind. And not to drag you into any political discourse per se, but governor basically saying, well, I trust the people of Texas to be smart enough to know whether or not they really should wear a mask. Do you see that reopening 100% of the state as a good thing, a bad thing? I think I know where you're going to come down on this, but I just wanted to hear it from the authority.
And you know that as a public health official, there's no way I can say that that's a good thing. You know that.
Yeah.
People always ask questions that they know the answer to. Of course I can't say that. And you know, if you look back, I bet in the spring we were doing really good. You know, we were. And then we opened up, and then, you know, the numbers started to rise again. And the direction that we were going in a couple of weeks ago was pretty positive. I would have been more comfortable if we had not opened up for another couple of weeks or so. Because right now we're in spring break. And, you know, our reports are that a lot of folks were traveling. A lot of folks were gathering without masks. And so that's really like rolling the dice. Now, I understand the dilemma between balancing our economy and curbing certain behavior. I really understand that, because there are people that are actually suffering from an economic standpoint.
Sure.
And I think there needs to be a balance. But I'm just hoping that rolling of the dice is in our favor, to be honest with you. And I think it really is by kicking a step.
Thanks for stepping into that. I wanted to touch on something important to my younger brother, who on the 15th was looking forward to being part of this new group 1C, because he's over 50 and under 64. that's kind of different from what the CDC has been saying 1C would be here in Texas. What's the latest on that kind of expansion of the program to another category, and what do you see coming next?
You know, I have to acknowledge that I am a member of what is called the Expert Vaccine Advisory Panel, where we advise the state health director regarding vaccine rollout. And it's at his discretion to accept our advice or not. One thing that we did early on is we were very consistent with CDC in defining 1A. It was pretty obvious that we needed to take care of our healthcare infrastructure. So get those healthcare providers, those individuals in nursing homes who were more at risk, get them protected early on. That was actually a good thing. We in Texas pivoted a little bit from the panel's perspective. When you looked at the data, you looked at who was more at risk of suffering more severe consequences if they got COVID. And the thing that defined that most of all was age. Mm. So we defined 1D as individuals that were 65 and above. Because individuals that died from COVID, there were, I think it was around over 70% of the individuals was over 65. And so that was a very logical step. Mm-hmm. The next logical step was ensuring that those people who had chronic conditions, who were also likely to suffer more severe consequences if they got COVID. And so therefore, those individuals that were 16 and above with chronic conditions were also included in 1B. When we looked at 1C, use the same thought process. If we went down to 50, we knew that we would capture 93% of those individuals who had died from COVID. Mm-hmm. So it was quite natural to go to 50. The White House inserted teachers into that category. I understand it. I understand the public sentiment. But when you looked at the epidemiology around that, it didn't really hold true for that particular work sector. And the thing that we said with the panel is that we don't want to pick winners and losers. We didn't want to pick one employment sector over another. Mm-hmm. So all sectors were covered in our definition of the categories that we picked. And I'm hoping that your brother, who's over 50, will have access to a vaccine, because we're advising everyone to take advantage of getting that vaccine.
Yeah.
Best vaccine is the one that you have access to.
You know, we've been saying that on Open Journal for months and months now, as the vaccine has been rolled out, that the best one is the one you can get. Yeah. And that you should grab it and go. Do you have any insight for us on the subset of our population who have just chosen, either claiming personal freedom or risk aversion, that they're just not going to do it? I have a brother-in-law out in Katy who, no, I'm not doing it. It's like, well, what are you expecting, a free ride on my herd immunity? Or, you know.
Well, I think that is around, I'm saying, somewhere between 30 and 40%.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that as more people get vaccinated, that number will go down.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that when people see that there are not really adverse impacts of taking any vaccine, that they will be willing to do that. The other thing is that we really need over 70 to 80% of the individuals to actually get vaccinated in order to get to herd immunity. You know, I'd probably pay somebody to take a vaccine, because I want to go back and hear some live music again.
So, I'm with you.
Right. Will you please take those dollars and take that vaccine so that I can go hear some live music and feel comfortable doing it? You know, yeah. I mean, that's what it's about. I mean, to me, it is about responsibility. I don't think this is political, but, and maybe it's generational, whatever. But, you know, growing up, we had to take like civics classes, and we were taught things around, you know, citizenship and responsibility for the broader community. And I'm thinking that we need to get back to something like that, because when you have individuals that are really, you know, if you made a decision and it only affects you, that's fine. You don't want to do that. But that's not the case with COVID. That is not the case. Remember, 40% of the people are asymptomatic that get it. So you could actually have it and be transmitting it and not even know it.
As you talk about community and the fear of vaccination and the narrative around this being somewhat of a hoax or whatever the narrative is, surprisingly, it does transcend race and it does transcend economics, and somehow it infuses politics in it. It's a weird math. But you've really focused, or the health department has really focused on COVID-19 response that has access and equity and really hitting vulnerable populations in a way that I think most people take for granted. Why is that so important? And what are some of those efforts that you've done to really hit this underserved community?
Well, access and equity has always been a value of public health. And with COVID, we've had an opportunity to demonstrate that, starting with testing. We looked at zip codes where there were high positivity rates, and we tried to ensure that our testing sites were in those zip codes where there were high positivity rates. We also, in that testing strategy, looked at testing in a zip code that actually got tested. And so using the combination of both positivity rates as well as the percentage of people who had actually been tested actually guided the location of our testing site. Now, with vaccinations, we're doing something similar, but we're using what's called a COVID vulnerability index to guide our efforts. And that's one of the things that we're looking at. And that actually is what the CDC developed, a social vulnerability index, but we also looked at issues related to the healthcare infrastructure and issues around COVID itself. So we used that. We looked at, you might be familiar with our wastewater testing. There are 39 wastewater plants within the city of Houston, and we're able to detect COVID and do projections related to that. So we looked at that as well as positivity rates to come up with Tier 1 and Tier 2 zip codes that we would actually target for our vaccines. We have been able to transfer vaccines to a couple of Walgreens that were in those zip codes. We've actually targeted a federally qualified health centers, Empecina Health Center, Hope Center, that were in a couple of those zip codes. We also transferred vaccine to Harris Health Clinic because they weren't getting a lot of vaccine at one point. Are also in those zip codes. We have it's a callback list. We call it a waiting list. But we're able to target those individuals from those Tier 1 and Tier 2 zip codes to schedule appointments for NRG, as well as our Bayou Center and our Del Mar Center, as well as our four health clinics. We believe that that's a start. We understand that we're going to have more grassroots efforts in order to do that. For example, we worked with the mayor's office and did two sites this weekend at African-American churches. We picked the one church in the north, one church in the south, but it was really engaging ministers from both the north and the south to get names of individuals who met the criteria to be tested. Very much hands-on, very much grassroots. This is something we want to continue to replicate.
Well, Stephen, I wanted to ask a question as we wind up our time together. Houston is known for many things, among which is our resiliency as a city. We've suffered through floods and hurricanes and Arctic storms and pandemics. What do you see as the impact on economics, mental health? How can we mitigate that in the future here in this very resilient city we share that is Houston, Texas?
You know, I don't really want to be cynical, but we're resilient. Most people, when threatened with a common enemy, will come together, you know, to pull themselves out of it. And we've done that. You know, we've seen our share of hurricanes. And in this department, we've had to respond to fires, We've had to respond to explosions almost every. And that's a good thing that we come together in order to pull ourselves out. But we need to ask ourselves the question, how can we translate that behavior that we exhibit when we're responding to crisis into a more of a routine behavior, more of a cooperative spirit, more of a sacrificing spirit, where we actually are not so much in competition, but actually building on the gifts of individual partners in order to make our city better. And it really, I think, equates to focusing on those systemic issues around poverty, around access to healthcare, and around education. Because the reality is those people who were more self-sufficient in every one of those situations fared better. Even if their house was flooded, even if it was, you know, burned down or blown away or whatever, because they had insurance, you know, in their house, because they had access to health care, they fared better. It is those individuals that are really challenged socioeconomically that don't fare as well. And so the question is, what can we do as a community to ensure that all boats actually rise with the tide? That's really what we need to look at. It sounds kind of high in the sky. I don't think it is. It's practical. It gets back to, what are you willing to sacrifice and what compromises are you willing to make to ensure that we all benefit from the wealth of this country and particularly this community?
You know, as you say that and we talk to the future, you're an adjunct professor at the University of Texas School of Public Health. As you look into the young eyes or this new budding generations, regardless of their age and background, do you see optimism? Do you see those kindred values of what you're talking about?
I think that they are optimistic. I think that we need to add a level of realism and practicality to that in order to ensure that it makes a difference. That is something that is foundational that we can, in fact, build on. But we have to give them a chance.
Right.
Well, Stephen, and in terms of giving them a chance, what is the way listeners can most easily avail themselves of the chance to access the information, the programs, and all of the information available that the Houston Health Department has to share?
Well, you can go online at houstonemergency.org related to COVID. You can also, if you're needing information, you can call 832-393-4220 for COVID-related information or for a vaccine availability or to make an appointment. But you can also go on our website in general and look at the programs that we offer. My appointment was canceled early today with my staff, and I actually sneaked into the optometrist's office, number one, to clean my glasses and to get an eye exam because I haven't had one in 2 years. As you know, COVID was here last year, and this is what I usually do. I said, no, I'm not going to that office. But anyhow, and Aaron and I were talking, and we introduced ourselves, and he was talking about one of our programs, See to Succeed, where we actually give free eye exams to school children. We started out with 400 a week. At our peak, we were seeing over 400 a day and seeing over 11,000 a year. And he was excited. He was telling me about the program. I said, well, you're looking at the person that really, you know, was the impetus for the program. But then we started to talk, and he felt a sense of pride about being able to do that because he volunteers. And we were talking about how just that simple act alone results in academic achievement and results in an improvement in attendance. And believe it or not, it results in lowering behavioral issues on campus. And so I say that to say that all the things that we're are facing can actually be solved with simple acts. We don't have to make it complicate it. We can just take it on and agree to work together to solve those issues. And I'm hoping that if you go on our website, you'll see a lot of things that we're involved in. And if people, you know, are interested in volunteering, of course, we are in a COVID environment. We will keep that in mind. So when there are opportunities to serve, working with your health department, just make yourself available. So go on our website. I'm encouraging everybody to take your best shot when you're eligible for the COVID vaccine. Continue to wear your mask. Continue to social distance and engage in, you know, simple hygiene, hand washing. Remember, we didn't have much of a flu season this year, and there's a reason for that. Most people have masks on.
Well, Stephen Williams, thank you so much for sharing some of your wealth of information with us here on Open Journal.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure being here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Well, we're very excited for the work that you've done in the health department, and we'll keep looking to see what's on the horizon with life post-pandemic and all of the other things that the health department is doing to keep us safe.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. It is time to wrap this edition of Open Journal. We thank you for tuning in and joining us. We thank you for supporting this independent community station. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. This program and previous programs can be found through the archive at kpft.org. And please subscribe to our podcast, KPFT OJ. We are a dedicated all-volunteer production staff, including Rambling, Rick Campbell, Susan Phillips, and Maverick. Open Journal theme music by Kevin McLeod. Join us on Open Journal next time for more great conversations. And thank you for your continued support.
And as always, we'd like to leave you with a thought to carry you through the week. This comes to us from Mother Teresa, who said, "I used to pray that God would feed the hungry or do this or that, but now I pray that he'll guide me to do whatever I'm supposed to do, what I can do. I used to pray for answers, but now I'm praying for strength. I used to believe that prayer changes things, but now I know that prayer changes us and we change things." Take care of each other. Peace.